conference on Friday. It was just after she learned that her husband may well have been killed.
I want Putin and all of his entourage, Putin's friends and his government to know that they will be held accountable for what they have done to our country, to my family and to my husband, and that day will come very soon.
Do you have that same kind of confidence, Masha? You've written that the death of Navalny doesn't indicate the strength, the weakness of Putin, but his strength. We just have 30 seconds.
Yeah. I don't have that same kind of confidence, but I admire Yulia Navalny's confidence. And 2 hours ago, she actually made another address, and she said she's going to be stepping into Navalny's shoes, and I think she's going to lead the movement that he founded. It was an extraordinary address, and I recommend that every viewer search for it on YouTube when the show is over.
And the significance of his mother going to the penal colony? 15 seconds.
The mother went to the penal colony hoping to pick up Navalny's body. The body has not been released, most likely because the body bears the traces of whatever was used to kill him.
Masha Gessen, we want to thank you for being with us, staff writer at The New Yorker magazine, award-winning Russian-American journalist, author of numerous books, including most recently, Surviving Autocracy. That does it for our show. We'll link to your latest piece on Alexei Navalny. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. KBOO's Board of Directors meets on the fourth Monday of the month at 6 p.m. This month's meeting will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland and online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting virtually can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
Thank you for tuning in to KBOO Community Radio during this special programming campaign, All Thrills, No Frills, Volume 3. This February and March, you will hear different marathons and series, all brought to you by our talented programmers. If you'd like to help KBOO reach our $22,000 goal by March 16th, go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to the number 44321 right now. We thank you, and you're welcome.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Oregon students are still lagging behind their pre-pandemic learning levels while the rest of the country rebounds.
Washington State considers legislation to make it harder to close libraries.
And in international news, Greece legalizes same-sex marriage.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, February 19th, 2024. I'm Ezra.
And I'm Nathan Vandiver. Oregon students are still lagging behind their pre-COVID learning levels, according to an analysis by Harvard and Stanford universities. In the 29 other states that were studied, students are on the rebound, but Oregon kids have failed to regain either their math or reading skills from the COVID era's disruption. Elementary and middle school students are two-thirds of a year behind on reading and three-quarters of a year in math on average. That's 2 to 3 times the deficit that other students are facing around the country. Why? Well, it can't be chalked up to having longer school closures than other states. Washington and California had similar closures, and their students are bouncing back. Charlene Williams, head of Oregon Department of Education, points to Oregon's unusually short school year as one potential culprit, and the tradition of local school district control. There are some learning strategies that Oregon could be doing to increase student achievement, like one-on-one tutoring and summer school. But $1 billion in federal pandemic aid was spent in the state's 197 school districts, but there was little control for what the money was spent on. At least 20% of those funds had to be spent toward academic recovery, but many districts spent their funds on non-academic priorities. Things like capital projects got an influx of cash. State policymakers will need to act since the federal pandemic grants expire in just 8 months. Student achievement matters both for individuals and for the state. High K through 12 achievement is connected to higher per capita income, lower crime rates, and fewer teen pregnancies.
The Washington State Legislature is considering a bill to make it more difficult to dissolve a library district. Senate Bill 5824 updates the outdated statutes that nearly allowed the Columbia County Rural Library District to shut down last year. The bill passed unanimously in the Senate, but hasn't been voted on in the House yet. Locals raised concerns over books on race, gender, sexuality, and consent on their shelves, materials community critics called, quote, pornographic and offensive, according to OPB. There's only one library in the district, in Dayton, and it's the only one for miles. Librarians refused to remove the 11 books people called offensive. Todd Vandenbark is the former library director. He said, quote, the simple reason is that they were not, and it would be a violation of the First Amendment rights of people who would want to read those titles. The library moved the books to a divided case in the young adult section and added a feature to the minors' library cards that allowed parents to decide which books they were comfortable with their children checking out. With the censorship effort thwarted, the residents started trying to dissolve the library. The American Library Association documented over 1,300 attempts to censor U.S. library books in 2022. Had they succeeded, the Columbia County Rural Library District would have been the first ever library to dissolve due to a censorship attempt.
Dissatisfied community members collected signatures to get a measure on the ballot that would close the library. It only took 107. Columbia County Superior Court Commissioner Julie Carl said people, quote, willfully and deliberately engaged in fraud in collecting the signatures. She blocked the Columbia County Auditor's Office from printing the measure on the ballot. Libraries provide not only books, but resources for small communities. They're used as cooling centers and distribute Narcan. They're often a lifeline for the disadvantaged. Now Washington State stepped in with protections. A law that hadn't been updated since 1974 only required 10% of active voters to sign on to get the measure on the ballot. Now it's been increased to 25%. David Elliott is the policy director for the Secretary of State in Washington. He said, quote, it ought to take as many signatures to destroy a library as it does to pull one of the officers. Bill 5824 passed unanimously in the Washington State Senate. The Washington State House will hear the bill later this week. Senator Sam Hunt of Olympia said, quote, we're trying to give people a voice and not let a minority rule. Closing libraries is a stupid idea, end quote.
The trend toward consolidation among healthcare facilities would be curbed in Washington State if Senate Bill 5241 makes it through the legislature. Eric Tegedoff reports from Olympia.
A bill in Olympia aims to protect Washingtonians against restricted healthcare access and rising costs from hospital mergers. Consolidation in the healthcare market has become a growing concern for some in Washington State. A 2022 Office of Financial Management report found the number of hospitals that are part of larger systems grew from 10% in 1986 to nearly 50% in 2017. Sam Hatzenbieler with the Economic Opportunity Institute says this has been bad news for Washingtonians, which is why Senate Bill 5241 is needed.
The bill would give the Attorney General oversight over potential mergers and acquisitions and would give them the power to stop them or place conditions on these mergers if they would be shown to reduce access to care or increase costs for patients.
Organizations, including the Washington State Hospital Association and Washington State Medical Association, have testified against the bill, saying it could tie the hands of hospitals that are struggling financially to survive. The measure has passed in the Senate and is scheduled for an executive session in the House Committee on Civil Rights and Judiciary on Tuesday. Washingtonians have a legal right to access abortion. However, some in the state have seen access restricted in hospital mergers, especially in rural parts of the state where there may be only one option. Courtney Norman, the Washington State Director for Planned Parenthood Alliance Advocates, says sometimes the larger entity in an acquisition is a corporation that doesn't offer abortion services.
So you may have a community that previously was receiving access to birth control, abortion care, cancer screenings, and more. And then suddenly that's being taken away because of a consolidation.
Norman says the legislation is critical for Washingtonians.
We're talking about many times life and death issues, and in the interest of preserving access to health care for all, we should not just put the ease of corporations that don't want to have to deal with some paperwork over the needs of our patients and our communities, especially in the rural parts of Washington.
For Washington News Service, I'm Eric Tegedov.
Same-sex marriage is now legal in Greece. It's the first Christian Orthodox majority country to do so. Queer couples will also now be allowed to legally adopt after Thursday's vote in Parliament. Anti-gay members of the Orthodox Church held a protest rally in Athens. Archbishop Hieronymus, the head of the Orthodox Church, said it would, quote, corrupt the homeland's social cohesion. The bill passed by simple majority. The prime minister said, quote, the reform makes the lives of several of our fellow citizens better without taking away anything from the lives of the many.
Experts say women are often overlooked when it comes to heart disease, but it's their leading cause of death. Dr. Abigail Kahn is a cardiologist at Oregon Health and Science University, and she has advice. KBOO reporter Matea Carlin has more on the story.
February is American Heart Month, a time to focus on potential cardiovascular risks. Health experts say women especially should consider their heart health. Heart disease is the number one killer of women, more deadly than all forms of cancer combined. However, OHSU cardiologist Dr. Abigail Kahn says it's often thought of as a disease that largely affects men, and so treatments have been tailored toward men.
Women tend to be less aware of their heart risk, and when they get treatment, it's often delayed, and maybe a treatment that's more tailored to men than to women.
Kahn notes that it's actually an exciting time because we know more than ever about how to treat heart disease in women. The challenge is spreading the word about these advances. Kahn says people might imagine a person clutching their chest as a sign of a cardiac event.
Women may present with more subtle signs. They may present with more symptoms like shortness of breath or nausea. Or, in some cases, they might present with chest pain, but it's assumed to be something else.
Kahn has some general advice for maintaining good heart health.
Having a normal, healthy blood pressure, and if your blood pressure is high, getting treatment for that. Preventing diabetes, prediabetes, other associated conditions, eating a healthy diet, being physically active, reducing stress.
For KBOO News and the Oregon News Service, I'm Matea Carlin.
Systemic racism is related to how people learn and the way cities are organized, according to a new study by New Mexico's nonprofit Santa Fe Institute. The study was published February 6th in Nature Communications. Roz Brown has the story.
The city where you live could be making you, your family, and your friends more unconsciously racist. Or, by contrast, it could make you less racist. Study findings from New Mexico Santa Fe Institute show how population, diversity, and segregation combine to form a person's unconscious racial bias. Lead author Andrew Steer examined why that's true in some cities more than others. He says the research showed those who rub elbows with many different kinds of folks revealed less prejudice.
You learn to do that because you interact with people that are different from you, and you learn something that is not a stereotype about them, and you think of that person as a person.
Steer says diverse interactions force people to adapt to new situations and learning. The study is based on data from the popular online implicit association test, which asks volunteers to categorize their response when given a pairing of white or black faces with positive or negative words. A faster association of white equals good or black equals bad can show inherent racial bias. To build their model, the researchers took the average IAT bias scores from almost 3 million individuals in different geographic areas and linked them to racial demographics and population data from the U.S. Census. Steer says many cities create dense and diverse networks of social interaction, but not all, including Chicago, where he lived for 10 years.
If you have a city that is very diverse, but very segregated like Chicago is, that diversity doesn't get you that much in terms of not being racist. So it's not just your psychology, but also who you can access and what types of opportunities you can have.
He notes that in cities where people can't encounter and interact with people and institutions used by other groups, racial biases create major barriers to equity and amplify disparities, including access to medical care, education, employment, policing, mental health outcomes, and physical health. This is Roz Brown, New Mexico News Connection.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Coast Range Radio. At 6, it's Labor Radio. At 6:30, it's Prison Pipeline. Then at 7, Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather, rainy with a low temperature of 40 degrees. Tomorrow's weather, 40% chance of rain with a high of 58 degrees. Today in history, in 1878, Thomas Edison patented the phonograph. It played back recordings using a vibrating needle and embossed disc. It was the predecessor to the modern record player. The quote of the day is from Edison, who said, quote, "I'd put my money on the sun and solar energy. What a source of power. I hope we don't have to wait until oil and coal run out before we tackle that. I wish I had more years left."
The National Park Service will cut its contract with Aramark over unsafe conditions at Crater Lake. Since 2019, conditions at Crater Lake have been getting worse, with reports of fuel leaks, food safety issues, and increasing visitor complaints. Former staff described the employee housing as, quote, disgusting and filthy, and there are no security measures to protect employee safety. Aramark's 2023 review was the worst it's received yet. The Parks Service Director, David Szymanski, said in a written statement, quote, "Termination would be an extremely rare action and one we don't take lightly, but consistent failures to meet contract requirements led to our notice of intent to terminate this contract to protect visitors and park resources," end quote. The contract will end unless Aramark can provide good reason as to why it shouldn't. A short-term contractor would need to take over operations when Aramark is removed from the park.
Portland is biking more. After a 2022 report showed an alarming downturn, the latest report brings better news. About 5% more people were biking. The upward trend is new. However, it's still a major decrease from 10 years ago. Traffic deaths in Portland are more frequent than they have been in years, and there's work to be done to make the roads safer. The climate crisis brings a new urgency to the need to get people out of single-occupancy cars and onto alternative methods of transit. According to the census data, just over 7% of Portlanders commuted on bikes in 2014. In 2021, not even 3% reported cycling to work. COVID and the shift to remote work impacted both estimates. Compared to 2022, the amount of cyclists has increased by nearly 5%. A significant portion of riders are on e-bikes. The preliminary report data is available at portland.gov's transportation section of the website.
The White House stresses support for Ukraine ahead of the Russian invasion's two-year anniversary. A conservative coalition writes a game plan for an anti-woke government, and Trump starts to grapple with his massive fraud judgment. With more on the story, it's Alex Gonzalez with 2024 Talks.
Welcome to 2024 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
President Zelensky, the stakes of your fight remain high for your country and for the entire world. And it is in the strategic interest of the United States to continue our support.
Vice President Kamala Harris underscored U.S. backing for Ukraine ahead of the two-year anniversary of Russia's invasion. Since October, the White House has pressed for $60 billion in support as part of a foreign aid package that just passed the Senate. House Speaker Mike Johnson has not said if or when it will come to the floor and could risk rebellion from his hard-right flank. Former Wyoming Republican Representative Liz Cheney says it's worth Johnson losing the speakership over. Given Russia's aggression and the death in custody of dissident leader Alexei Navalny, Cheney argues Johnson Johnson needs to be on the right side of history.
He ought to understand that it is worth it if he has to lose his speakership in order to make sure that freedom survives, in order to make sure that the United States of America continues to play its leadership role in the world.
Some legal analysts say former President Donald Trump will have trouble trying to overturn last week's massive fraud judgment against his business empire. One former prosecutor told MSNBC that Judge Arthur Engoron's ruling was written carefully, to the point of being nearly appeal-proof. In Michigan over the weekend, Trump again attacked his critics.
This is merely an election interference ploy by a crazed lunatic attorney general working closely with a very bad judge.
After interest, the Trump Organization would pay nearly $500 million, and he would be barred from doing business in New York for 3 years. Meanwhile, the Heritage Foundation has published a dramatic plan for a next Republican administration. Project 2025 would target what it calls the totalitarian cult of the Great Awakening and could create huge permanent changes to the CDC, EPA, and other important agencies. Professor Kerry Baker at Smith College says one key part would transform the enforcement of civil rights laws in ways that are future-proof and can't easily be undone.
What usually happens is a Republican government gets in and puts in place certain policies, and then a Democratic government wins and they reverse some of those policies. What this report is setting out is a strategy to make conservative policies permanent.
Arizona lawmakers have introduced legislation to make it easier for politicians to act against deep fakes during campaigns. Karthik Ramakrishnan is founder of Armilla AI. He calls for more focus on the AI models campaigns are using and says Americans will need to become skeptical.
Not taking everything at face value, but doing that second or third order research, because this is about voting. This is about democracy and this is about your franchise.
The Federal Communications Commission recently banned robocalls that use AI to fake voices. Ramakrishnan says AI isn't always bad and adds it'll be hard to stop entirely, which is why he favors Arizona's approach. I'm Alex Gonzalez for Pacific Network and Public News Service. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
Interior Secretary Deb Haaland is the first Native American to serve as a U.S. Cabinet Secretary, but at the most recent National Congress of American Indians session, tribal leaders say they don't see the Interior Department as an ally. With that story and more, it's Jill Freitas with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Jill Freitas, sitting in for Antonia Gonzalez. Interior Secretary Deb Haaland is making history as the first Native American to serve as the U.S. Cabinet Secretary. While she's beloved in Indian country, at the National Congress of American Indians winter session, some tribal leaders report they still don't see the Interior Department as an ally. Matt Laszlo has the story from Washington.
In his State of Tribal Nations address on Monday, NCAI President Mark Macaro tipped his hat to President Joe Biden.
Under this presidency, there are more Native Americans in the highest levels of government than ever before, from the White House to so many agencies of government.
Bernadine Atchison, Council Chair of Alaska's Kanaiti Indian Tribe, praises Secretary Haaland.
It's amazing because it sets good role models, like for our children that, you know, and grandchildren.
Cheryl Andrews Maltese is Chairwoman of the Wampanoag Tribe of Gayhetaquina.
We're on the island of what we call Nopi, and everybody else knows as Martha's Vineyard off the coast of Massachusetts.
Andrews Maltese used to work for the Bureau of Indian Affairs and has high praise for Secretary Haaland. Still, she says her tribe has butted heads with the Biden administration over its 30 by 30 initiative to conserve 30% of America's land and water by 2030.
Waters rose, creating our island over 10,000 years ago. So all the areas right out to what they call the continental shelf break, where it actually goes down, all that was dry land. And that has all of our living patterns and our archaeological history contained submerged underneath the water. But we're trying to protect that, and it seems to compete with the administration's need and desire to meet their 30 by 30 slogan.
Dallas Owen is a member of the Sisseton Wahpeton Oyate tribe of North and South Dakota. He says his tribe is still jumping through too many federal hoops and hurdles.
I know she's probably doing the best she can, but do I expect more? Yes. Am I going to be at a loss if nothing comes to fruition? Probably not, because I know the position she's in, and at the end of the day, unless they cut red tape, it's just what it is.
Ashley Hemmers is an enrolled member of the Fort Mojave Indian Tribe. She says part of the way tribes were able to secure protections for the sacred Avikume National Monument was through bypassing Washington and working with other tribes first.
We're very sovereign driven. So, you know, we know we wanted to protect our sacred site and, you know, we can't rely on Washington, right?
For National Native News, I'm Matt Laszlo in Washington.
The Alaska Heritage Institute has published a book on the era of indigenous slavery in Alaska that endured more than two decades after the passage of the 13th Amendment to the federal constitution, which abolished the practice 2 years before Alaska became part of the United States in 1867. The book is about a Haida man named Sakwaw, who embarked on a courageous quest for freedom from his Tlingit owner and the trial that ultimately ended human bondage in 1886. Sakwaw explores how slavery came to exist and persist in Alaska, despite the federal act that banned it. The book was written by journalists Jeff Landfield and Paxton Wolber, along with attorney Lee Baxter. The investigative special feature first appeared on the political news site, The Alaska Landmine, and was reprinted through SHI's Box of Knowledge series. Wolber says the story of slavery in North America is incomplete without an understanding of slavery in Alaska. The book is available on the Sea Alaska Institute website. I'm Jill Freitas.
New research from Washington State shows the positive effects of trees in urban areas. Tree coverage is becoming more crucial as extreme heat events become more common in the Northwest. Eric Tegedoff reports.
Trees in urban areas provide benefits for people, including decreased temperatures and improved air quality, according to new research out of Washington State. The Greening Research in Tacoma initiative measured air temperatures across a neighborhood in the city to understand the effects of urban trees. Lead study author Dr. Eileen Ettinger with the Nature Conservancy in Washington says temperatures were as much as 18 degrees lower in areas with trees. Ettinger notes that trees are essential to mitigate the effects of climate change.
They reduce the probability of extreme heat occurring, the kind of heat that can be harmful for human health and can also just reduce the ability of people to do their work if they're working outside.
The Greening Research in Tacoma initiative is a partnership of the Nature Conservancy in Washington, University of Washington, Tacoma Tree Foundation, and Tacoma Urban Forestry Program. The study was published in the journal Scientific Reports. Lowell Wise, who heads the Tacoma Tree Foundation, says urban trees are also an environmental justice issue. He says the South Tacoma neighborhood where this study took place has half the canopy coverage of the rest of the city and is also more racially and ethnically diverse.
There's a growing awareness that the way the city is designed isn't fair for everybody, and people that live in this neighborhood really care about making change on all those fronts, environmental, social, and economic.
Wise says this work has gained greater urgency since the 2021 heat wave in the Northwest, which killed 8 people in Tacoma, including one in the neighborhood studied.
It's kind of becoming a life and death issue here to understand the urban heat island effect and start making investments in shade and cooling resources in these neighborhoods that are suffering the most from those kinds of events.
For Washington News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
The pesticide industry is making a push to prevent cities, states, and individuals from holding them accountable for getting people sick. The Idaho State Senate rejected a bill last week that would have granted pesticide manufacturers immunity from product liability lawsuits. A coalition of Idaho conservation groups lobbied hard against the measure. Mark Richardson has the details.
A coalition of advocacy groups have helped defeat a bill in the Idaho legislature that would have given the pesticide industry blanket immunity from liability lawsuits. The pesticide immunity bill was defeated 15-9 Friday by the Republican-controlled state Senate. The coalition was led by the Idaho Conservation League and included the Northwest Center for Alternatives to Pesticides, the Idaho Trial Lawyers Association, and the Idaho Association of Resource Councils. Jonathan Oppenheimer with the Conservation League says the motivation for them was consumer protection.
We're not coming at this from a perspective of pesticides shouldn't be used. We're coming at this from a perspective of there should be justice for those who may be harmed by using products if they are not warned about those potential health consequences.
Oppenheimer says the Senate's 5 Democrats joined with a group of right-wing Republicans to defeat the Idaho bill. He says the pesticide industry is pushing similar bills in several other states, including Missouri, Iowa, and Florida. Liability lawsuit immunity is controversial. Businesses say it keeps them from getting hit with multi-million dollar settlements, while consumer advocates say it closes the courthouse door. Oppenheimer says pesticide users who get sick would have little recourse.
The pesticide industry is seeking broad immunity that would shield them from failure to warn claims. As long as that label is approved by EPA and that the pesticide is approved for use in the United States, they would be immune from any liability.
Only a few major industries have either federal or state immunity from lawsuits. The best known are firearm manufacturers and the computer technology sector. In addition, most federal, state, and local governments are immune from the results of performing their statutory duties. Or Idaho News Service, I'm Mark Richardson.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Monday, February 19th, 2024. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2154. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Matea Carland and Ezra. The producer and engineer is Althea Billings. Special thanks to Eric Tegedoff, Roz Brown, Terry D., Jill Freitas, Alex Gonzalez, and Mark Richardson. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Nathan Vandiver.
And I'm Ezra. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for Coast Range Radio.
From the Coast Range Association, this is Coast Range Radio. I'm Michael Gaskill. So I don't have to tell anyone listening to this that here in the West, wildfires are a fact of life. I'm also sure that most folks listening are already aware that the climate crisis, combined with more and more homes being built in and around forest lands, is creating an escalating cycle of devastation in fire-prone communities. There is a tremendous amount of pressure on